Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Wednesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. He's also the co-author of Heavy Lifting. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today. We start with the good. It comes from the pages of the New York Times. Quote, a little-noticed health care provision that Senator Marco Rubio of Florida slipped into a giant spending law last year has tangled up the Obama administration, sent tremors through health insurance markets, and rattled confidence in the durability of President Obama's signature health law. So for all the Republican talk about dismantling the Affordable Care Act, one Republican presidential hopeful has actually done something toward achieving that goal. Mr. Rubio's efforts against the so-called risk corridor provision of the health law has hardly risen to the forefront of the race for the Republican presidential nomination, but his plan limiting how much the government can spend to protect insurance companies against financial losses has shown the effectiveness of quiet legislative sabotage. So to put it more succinctly into layman's terms, Rubio is making it very, very difficult for the government to bail out the insurance industry, and that could obviously mean a short-lived Affordable Health Care Act. Jim, sometimes doing things quietly can get a lot done.
Yeah. You and I in past martinis had observed that there's nothing quite like watching the insurance companies suddenly realize that Obamacare is a bad deal for them. Where did I put the world's smallest violin right there? After we had warned them, after we had, done everything humanly possible to stop the bill, and they spent billions of dollars or millions of dollars at least lobbying for the bill, running television ads for it to build up public support and things like that. So kudos to Rubio. And I'm just going to observe, if you're running for president in a Republican presidential primary, is there anything better than a New York Times headline declaring Marco Rubio sabotaged Obamacare? I mean, I'm sure they think of that as an attack headline, and somewhere they're like framing it. It's going to show up in ads. It's about as good a thing as you can get. There's been, little doubt of my frustration with a good portion of the discussions and with candidates in this presidential year. I feel like it's being a discussion of generalities. We have these outsider candidates who generally are less familiar than usual with the lawmaking process. It pays to pay attention to the details. And in this case, whether Rubio is just lucky or smart, this was always one of the – look, the whole thing was built like a Jenga tower, and it was held together with, duct tape from a couple of Supreme Court decisions. But here is, one very weak spot in that if you can get the insurance companies – that basically they signed on to this. They were totally convinced they're going to get this huge influx of new customers. They're not getting them in the rate that they wanted, and they're also getting them sicker and older than they expected, and that eventually this was a formula for more taxpayer bailouts. Good move, Rubio, and we'll see if this helps them in the presidential race, but it's nice to see that somebody was paying attention to the small stuff because sometimes it's worth sweating.
Jim, do you think this is a victory in the long run? Let's say it continues down this path. There's one point in here where it says Blue Cross and Blue Shield executives have warned the administration and Congress that eliminating the federal payments could have a devastating impact on insurance markets. It goes on to say it could mean much higher premiums, making it much harder for people to have coverage. But, of course, they have to have coverage. So as it's about to implode, will people say, well, this was a horrible idea from the start, we have to replace it, or Marco Rubio, this evil man, is making this system impossible to maintain, and we have to bail it out to keep it going? Who's going to win the PR fight there?
We're going to have another referendum on this. You can't say, I think Obamacare is a bad idea, and then vote for Obama in 2012. Right. Like, the fact that his name is in it would be your first clue that he supports it. Look, there are two options going to be in 2016. One of them is going to be Hillary Clinton to steer to the left. One's going to be to the right. If Hillary gets in there and the insurance companies say, this just can't work, we need more bailouts, one of two things will happen. There'll be some sort of attempted workaround to create a bailout by executive order, right? We've already seen enough damage done to the constitutional process. The second option there is that they'll say, look, the only other option we have is to move closer towards single payer. That the insurance companies cannot survive. Clearly, private industry was never meant to handle this sort of duty. Only the federal government can take care of us, and Hillary care comes a generation later. That's possibility one. Possibility two is a Republican gets in office, and I think it's safe to say that any of the Republican candidates are more likely to move us in a more free market direction, more likely to see insurance sold across state lines. What's also, I think, particularly intriguing is the idea that basically, look, we are putting our foot down under a Republican president saying, no more in bailouts for insurance companies. You guys have to figure out a way to make money. It seems like the premiums are plenty high enough You cannot look to the taxpayers as a piggy bank who will come and take care of you every time things get tough for you. And I think that that is the better option of the two, and more likely to get to this, because otherwise you end up in this, you know, slow slide towards single payer.
And that's certainly where we don't want to go. You mentioned Hillary's the likely nominee, but there could be some more trouble for her here as we head into the bad martini. And it's not because it's bad for her politically, but once again, the official story around the response to the Benghazi terrorist attack is crumbling thanks to Judicial Watch and the Freedom of Information Act. Judicial Watch today, meaning yesterday, released a new Benghazi email from then Department of Defense Chief of Staff Jeremy Bash to State Department leadership, immediately offering forces that could move to Benghazi during the terrorist attack on the U.S. Special Mission Compound in Benghazi, Libya, on September 11, 2012. In an email sent to top Department of State officials at 7:19 p.m. Eastern Time, only hours after the attack had begun, Bash says, quote, "We have identified the forces that could move to Benghazi. They are spinning up as we speak," unquote. The Obama administration redacted the details of the military forces available, oddly citing a Freedom of Information Act exemption that allows the withholding of deliberative process information. And so, Jim, the testimony from Leon Panetta and others that said there was never a stand-down order because we never thought we could get folks there in time, when ultimately there were folks fighting at the annex some 20 hours later, this just makes it seem worse and worse, the official narrative here.
Yeah, but here's the thing. This also kind of shakes my faith in Trey Gowdy a little bit. Correct me if I'm wrong. Didn't he say that the committee had that email a year ago?
I thought so, yeah.
So, one, why are we just learning about this now? At least from the initial glance, unless there's some sort of – unless like a minute or two later he emailed, wait, never mind. None of the stuff is ready.
Right.
So, unless there's some really extraordinary correction to that, I'd really love to know how the rest of the exchange went. Did somebody say, okay, get him moving? Did somebody at state or somebody in the chain of command say, whoa, let's double check. Might just be a protest over a video. You know, what came out of that exchange? Did it just get forgotten and lost in the confusion of that night? Why has this person who sent the email not testified? What happened there? If this is not the smoking gun, I'd like to know why it isn't what it appears to be. The administration classifying stuff that didn't need to be classified, we've kind of almost gotten used to that. But man, oh man, like we're just kind of left scratching our head. You know, this would appear to be exactly what the cynics and the critics had kind of had suspected was the administration's response, that, yeah, they could have done something that night, but they feared the consequences of launching major military action 2 months before Election Day 2012, after they said that bin Laden is dead, GM is alive, and that everything was going fine and Al-Qaeda was on the run. And now here we are. And so, you know, it's a deeply frustrating bit of a state of affairs in that, yeah, we can be angry at the Obama administration, but I'm a little bit angry at the Republican investigators that were learning about this in December 2015 about an event that occurred in September 2012. So this is the sort of thing you'd like to think would have been come out, if not in 2012, in a year. Like where is this? How much dust did they have to blow off before they brought this to the public's attention?
The truth is so much easier. Anyway, on to the crazy martini now. And of course, Hillary Clinton is the Democratic frontrunner. The only one who's really considered to be a threat on any level, although that appears to be dissipating, is Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. Sanders was in Baltimore yesterday talking about the need for more government investment in city neighborhoods to reduce poverty, to improve housing for poor people. And that was his message for the day. He then held a press conference after touring one of these neighborhoods. And even before he got there, his staff, as you point out in the Morning Jolt today, Jim, told reporters, don't ask about other stuff and especially don't ask about ISIS. Well, at the very end of the press conference, somebody asked about ISIS anyway. We know it's the last question because Sanders leaves once he's done talking about this. Here's Sanders' response.
All right, what about ISIS, guys? How often are these people talking about the issues that we talked about today? Of course I'll talk about ISIS. But today what we're talking about is a community in which half of the people don't have jobs. We're talking about a community in which there are hundreds of buildings that are uninhabitable. We're talking about a community where kids are unable to go to schools that are decent. You want to ask me about ISIS? We will talk about ISIS.
I get that wasn't the point of his event, Jim, but if you're running for commander-in-chief, you should be able to juggle a couple of issues, particularly the one that the most people are concerned about right now.
Greg, I am tired of hearing about the damn terrorist groups. I am running to punish the 1%, not to punish the terrorists, okay? That's very complicated foreign policy stuff. I am angry at rich people. I am running for the president of the United States in the year 1996, year of times of peace and prosperity. That's what I'm running about. I can't deal with any of this stuff today. I'm just angry, and my breakfast was cold, and I'm angry about that. I've got like 20 minutes more worth of Bernie Sanders material. And you know, here's the thing. The more he fades in the polls, the less that impression it does anyone any good. So he just seems indignant that anybody wants to ask about that sort of thing. It's like, you know, has anything happened like in the last week or two, Greg, that might have people thinking about? Like he just seems oblivious to it all. Ultimately, the core of the Democratic Party is functionally isolationist and pacifist. Not, doesn't want to think about this kind of stuff. Too many complicated compromises. Too many difficult choices. Doesn't fit the politically correct worldview. And for Bernie Sanders, he just doesn't want to deal with it. And so he wants to talk about poor people and how bad things are in the inner city, because it's a giant groundbreaking story. And we totally haven't had that situation be that case in those communities for decades. And yeah, so there we go. So, you know, and he's really indignant with those reporters. How dare you ask this question?
Jim, obviously he won several elections to the House. He's won twice elections to the Senate. Granted, it's in Vermont, which is a small state, but nonetheless, he's been politically successful. Yet, watching him run for president, it's almost like he doesn't get what he needs to do, because, like you referred to in his comment, he let Hillary off the hook with a great opportunity to strike some blows on her credibility and her honesty and her lack of secure of classified information with that question in the first debate. And now he's got another chance to talk about what a horrible job she did as Secretary of State. And
two observations, and this is actually, you know what, we usually end our martinis on a very exasperated note. This will actually be kind of hopefully an edifying note. So there's an old saying that, you know, the U.S. Senate is 100 guys who look in the mirror and see a president staring back at them.
Yes.
If you can't run and be president, then the next best – if you can't run and be Reagan, then the next best thing is to run and be Goldwater. Alternately, to run and be George McGovern, right? To be the guy who inspires you don't win, but you shape the party for a generation to come. You bring attention to the causes you think are important. You steer the philosophy and ideology of your party. You change, you know, you have a great influence beyond what your candidacy is. You could probably argue that Howard Dean had that impact on Democrats recently. Well, I think Bernie Sanders is a good example of that. I think you could probably argue that Lindsey Graham and or Rand Paul are having that kind of same kind of impact of trying to, you know, whether or not they win, they want to steer the party. Well, Bernie Sanders is all about the country stinks because of rich people. The reason you are poor is because of rich people. In the middle of the night, Bill Gates and Warren Buffett sneak into your house and they take money out of your wallet. That's kind of the gist if you listen to him. And he's just this raw populist rage. And that's what he, you know, and the other problem is that the reason he can't get his way, besides the fact that there's a Republican majority in the Senate, there's a Republican majority in the House, and it's been there since 2010. The reason he can't get his way is not any lack of persuasiveness on his own part. It's not any flaw in his ideas. It's not any misreading of the country as a whole and its center, political center of gravity or anything like that. No, no. The problem is big money in politics, because there are no lefties who have money in this country. There is, you know, he's one of those guys who believes his own fairy tales of these good noble crusaders up with the cows and Ben and Jerry up in Vermont, and that they could really bring about this openly socialist utopia if it wasn't for these big, mean, rich people. And that's how he sees these things. And it's a – you can – you know, it's an easy appeal, right? I mean, everyone likes to be in the Rebel Alliance. Nobody wants to be the evil empire. And he doesn't want to believe that, you know, the left has actually a ton of financial power, a ton of cultural power, a ton of institutional power in this country. They are the oppressed, you know, rebels who are going to overthrow this old decrepit system, and better days will be ahead. And that's why, you know, that's his philosophy, and he's selling it, and there are a lot of people who like it. And the thing is, taking on members of your own party or even pointing out the flaws in the Obama administration's foreign policy just doesn't fit that narrative, and it just doesn't interest Bernie Sanders. Now you know, and knowing is half the battle, Greg.
I almost feel like the little NBC star should be going past now.
Why do we need this militarism from G.I. Joe, you know? The kids, they learn about the guns.
On that note, Jim will be here all week with the Bernie Sanders impression, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today, and be sure to tune in again on Thursday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.